Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Dimerix Announcement Conference Call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There'll be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Dr. Nina Webster, Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator, and good morning to all of our guests. My name is Dr. Nina Webster, and I am the CEO and Managing Director of Dimerix. I appreciate your time in joining us on this teleconference, where we will be discussing today's announcement of our positive phase II clinical study results in patients with kidney disease. I would like to acknowledge that this teleconference does include forward-looking statements that are subject to risks and uncertainties. For those who have a copy of the presentation released this morning, slide 12 may be referred to later in the call. Also joining me on the call today is Associate Professor David Peckham and Professor Simon Roger, both investigators on the study and renal clinicians. I will hand over to Professor Peckham and Professor Roger a little later in the call to discuss the study results in more detail. But first, I'd like to give you an overview of Dimerix and the phase II study. For those of you who are not familiar with Dimerix, we are a publicly listed clinical stage biopharmaceutical company with a proprietary drug discovery platform which looks at the activity of drugs at the receptor level. Using this cell-based platform technology, Dimerix identified DMX-200 as a treatment for diabetic kidney disease, the topic for today, as well as for focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, or FSGS, a rarer kidney disease for which we reported positive phase IIa data several weeks ago, and for acute respiratory distress syndrome associated with COVID-19. And finally, receptor hit was also used to identify and characterize our preclinical candidate, DMX-700, for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. DMX-200 is an inhibitor of the chemokine receptor 2 pathway involved in the recruitment of immune cells to the area of inflammation. The use of DMX-200 is based on the fundamental understanding from this platform that many cellular receptors work together and require simultaneous inhibition to have an optimal effect. The DMX-200 program relies on our understanding that to suppress signaling of the chemokine receptor CCR2, we need to inhibit it at the same time as the angiotensin receptor. For patients with proteinuric kidney diseases, in other words, where the filters in the kidneys leak protein into the urine, including diabetic kidney disease, inhibition of the angiotensin 2 receptor with an inhibitor like irbesartan has for two decades provided the only clinically proven therapeutic intervention that can significantly delay progression of proteinuric kidney disease. Just to pause, protein loss in the urine is referred to as proteinuria, and a variable proportion of that total protein loss is albumin, which is typically measured in diabetic kidney disease and was also the marker measured in the 2017 Dimerix study. More recently, a new class of drugs, the SGLT2 inhibitors, which lower blood sugar, have shown additional benefits in delaying progression in diabetic kidney disease. By providing DMX-200 to patients already receiving the standard of care, we ensure that we are supporting the existing best practice treatment of these patients and at the same time targeting the two receptors simultaneously for this synergistic effect. For those who have followed us for some time, you may recall that Dimerix progressed into the current diabetic kidney disease and recently reported FSGS studies following some very compelling data from our previous open-label phase IIa study in chronic kidney disease in 2017. In that study, the 10 patients with primary renal diagnosis of diabetic kidney disease had an average baseline albumin loss in the urine, which I will refer to as ACR, of 210 milligrams per millimolar, or 1,856 milligrams per gram for those who are listening from overseas, and responded with an average 36% reduction of albuminuria after 26 weeks of treatment, with increasing doses of DMX-200 up to 240 milligrams per day. Diabetic kidney disease and FSGS were selected for subsequent studies since both of these types of disease appear to follow the same model of inflammation leading to sclerosis or scarring and ultimately failure of the kidney. We are very pleased to report study results consistent with our prior studies that continue to support the development of DMX-200 in kidney diseases. This phase II diabetic kidney disease study was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled crossover study designed to evaluate the safety and preliminary signs of efficacy of a 240 milligram daily dose of DMX-200 in patients with diabetic kidney disease who are receiving a stable dose of the blood pressure medication irbesartan. Each patient in the study received 12 weeks DMX-200 and 12 weeks placebo, separated by a 6-week washout period. This meant that every patient received treatment with DMX-200 and treatment with placebo, making it a powerful study design, although neither the patients nor the physicians knew which treatment they received first. I will now hand over to Professor Packham, who will walk you through the data.
Thank you, Nina, and good morning to everyone. It's my privilege to present to you the outcome of the Phase 2B Action for Diabetic Nephropathy trial. Before doing so, I should disclose I have been a Dimerix shareholder since the publication of the outcomes of the previous open-label Phase 2A trial of DMX-200 in patients with chronic kidney disease, with a variety of causes, but all accompanied by substantial ongoing proteinuria whilst on existing best therapy. As a little background on me, I'm a kidney specialist and am director of the Melbourne Renal Research Group. My main areas of research are in translational clinical research with an emphasis on what is by far the most common cause of end-stage renal failure, type 2 diabetic nephropathy. I confirm that I was an investigator on the current DMX-200 clinical trial for patients with diabetic nephropathy, as well as the previously announced FSGS study, and that I participated in the design of both the studies. I have also been an investigator on many of the global clinical trials that have led to new renal therapies over my career as a nephrologist spanning the last three decades. Type 2 diabetic nephropathy progresses by three important mechanisms. The first being overactivity or hyperfiltration of a reduced number of functioning filters in the kidney, leading to glomerular hypertension. This is the rationale for the long-established use of certain blood pressure medicines, inhibitors of the renin-angiotensin system. But two other mechanisms are also critically important. These are inflammation and infiltration of inflammatory cells within the kidneys, and also loss of specialized cells which comprise filters within the nephrons, or filters, called podocytes. Both of these mechanisms are targets for the therapeutic effects of DMX-200. Now, importantly, all three mechanisms increase the leakage of protein through the kidney filters and into the urine, so-called proteinuria. In diabetic kidney disease, by long tradition, we quantify proteinuria by measuring the specific protein, albumin, in the urine. The importance of levels of albumin in the urine is it correlates very well and directly with the rate of decline in kidney function. Reductions in albuminuria mean prolonging the life of the kidneys, and a 25% reduction in albuminuria has been shown to provide years of extended kidney survival. Once a person's kidneys have failed to levels below 10% of normal, renal replacement therapy, in other words, dialysis or transplantation, is necessary to keep the patient alive. Clearly, therefore, nephrological research is driven to discover new therapies that can prolong survival using reductions in albuminuria or proteinuria as a surrogate marker of benefit. These considerations prompted the design and execution of the diabetic nephropathy trial we're reporting today. 45 patients were enrolled in the Phase 2 study, with 40 patients qualifying for the final analysis. These population criteria were prospectively defined in the statistical analysis plan prior to the completion of the study. Three patients withdrew from the study for reasons not related to the study drug, and two patients had critical protocol deviations and were excluded from the statistical analysis. Additional analysis of all appropriate data collected will be reviewed and presented in more detail in due course. Across the study, the average age of the patients was 67 years old, ranging from 42 to 84 years. We recognize that many of these patients would have been on other medications, such as SGLT2 inhibitors and other blood glucose lowering agents. And any effect of concomitant medications are part of the full data review over the next few weeks. The primary endpoint of the study was the percent change from baseline in the 24-hour urine albumin loss as measured by the albumin-creatinine ratio after 12 weeks treatment with DMX-200 as compared to placebo. Although a statistically significant difference in reduction of albuminuria for the primary endpoint was not seen in the overall analysis, showing no conclusive benefit of DMX-200 compared to placebo across the entire cohort of diabetic kidney disease, and only a 2% difference compared to placebo, subsequent analysis has shown statistically and clinically significant variation in treatment response for patients who have higher levels of albuminuria at the study baseline. Now, if you have a copy of the slide that was published this morning on the company website, please take a look at slide 12 because it's extremely important and it explains what I'm trying to get across to you in terms of the effect. In view of the worst prognosis of patients with higher baseline albuminuria, a secondary analysis of patient response above and below the internationally well-established threshold of 500 milligrams per gram in the scientific units we use in Australia, the units we would use are 57 milligrams per millimole, was performed. So 57 is the critical number. The number of patients who fell into this group was a majority, 26 patients. And in that group, there was an 18% reduction overall in albuminuria, and this achieved statistical significance. Now, very importantly, in terms of clinical significance, 64 of those patients demonstrated a reduction in albuminuria corrected for placebo. And 56% of the patients in the higher baseline albuminuria group showed a treatment effect of greater than 25% than that achieved by pre-existing best therapy. A confounding factor when we look at the cohort as a whole was the fact that the placebo group, so all patients when they were receiving placebo, showed a fall in albuminuria of 12% as opposed to 14% when they were receiving active drug. And this impacted statistical significance. The explanation for this fall in the placebo arm is not clear at this stage, but it could indicate a legacy effect of prior treatment with DMX-200 or concomitant medications. This is a feature of the crossover design that we will be able to explore as part of the additional analysis. The increased treatment effect of DMX-200 in patients with diabetic kidney disease and the higher level of albuminuria is consistent with the strong treatment effects seen in the recent 2A study in patients with FSGS, where patients started with an average baseline of albuminuria of 340 milligrams per millimole or 3,005 milligrams per gram. And the previous 2A study completed in 2012 data in chronic kidney disease where patients with diabetic kidney disease started with an average baseline albuminuria of 210 milligrams per millimole or 1,856 milligrams per gram. Just to remind you, in contrast, in this study, patients started with an average baseline albuminuria of 116 milligrams per millimole, so substantially lower, or 1,028 milligrams per gram, and ranged from 30 milligrams per millimole to 406 milligrams per millimole, or 296 milligrams per gram to 4,293 milligrams per gram. And what is really pleasing is that the strongest response to DMX was seen in the patients with the highest urinary albumin levels and therefore the worst prognosis. It supports the mechanism of action of DMX-200 that focuses on reducing recruitment of inflammatory immune cells to the areas of active inflammation. analysis of treatment response by levels of urinary MCP1 and other markers of inflammation in this study will be undertaken. These and additional analyses of the data set are underway, and any meaningful outcomes beyond those reported here today, including the impact of other concomitant medications, including specifically the SGLT inhibitors, will be published if appropriate. I'd now like to hand over to Professor Roger to tell you more about the significance of these results as they apply to patients in the clinical setting. Simon.
Thank you, Dr. Packham. I'm a renal physician, like David, and I'm Director of Renal Research at Gosford. I'm head of the Department of Renal Medicine and also Visiting Medical Officer at Gosford Hospital. And thirdly, Conjoint Professor of the University of Newcastle. Personally, I've conducted over 90 investigator-initiated and pharmaceutical industry-sponsored drug trials over the last 22 years. I can confirm that I was an investigator on the current DMX200 clinical trial for patients with diabetic kidney disease, as well as lead for the previously announced FSGS study. There are three areas I would like to cover this morning. Firstly, the clinical importance of diabetes and chronic kidney disease. Secondly, the implications from the action for DKD trial in terms of safety and secondary endpoints. And thirdly, what the future might hold. The most common cause of kidney disease in Australia is diabetes. About one in three of all people with diabetes develop kidney disease when the high blood sugar levels damage blood vessels and the filters in the kidneys, stopping them from filtering waste properly. For the last 5 years at least, it is the commonest cause of patients requiring dialysis, but almost 40% of all patients on renal replacement therapy. As David mentioned, protein in the urine is a surrogate marker for progression of both diabetic and non-diabetic kidney disease. Therapy is currently targeted at reducing albuminuria to slow the rate of decline of kidney function. However, unfortunately, not everyone can tolerate the angiotensin II receptor blockers and the tablets that treat blood sugar, the SGLT2 inhibitors. High potassium levels or low blood pressure with the former, or dizziness and thrush with the latter, can really limit their use. Hence, there is a need for alternate medicines to slow the rate of progression of kidney disease. Just imagine being a 70-year-old on dialysis three times per week, 5 hours each session, feeling horrible after each treatment. Anything to delay the patient's entry onto dialysis would be greatly welcomed. Secondly, let's focus on the trial. In this study, Action for DKD, the cohort with albuminuria over 57 milligram per millimole, or the 500 milligram per gram, resulted in an 18% reduction in albuminuria from baseline compared to placebo was observed with a confidence interval of 0.03, meaning that it was both statistically and also clinically significant. I say clinically significant as this may well translate to several more years of life of the kidney for these patients, and this is extremely pleasing to see. The secondary endpoints for the study included an assessment of the frequency of patients who achieved a 30% or more reduction in albuminuria, as well as safety and other biomarker analyses. 25% of the study participants had a 30% or higher reduction in albuminuria, which should translate to a slowing of disease progression. And I know this is a great outcome for these patients and very compelling. Importantly, the preliminary safety findings showed that DMX200 was safe and well tolerated, and with no variation in the incidence or severity of adverse events between treatment with the active drug or placebo. This is consistent with existing safety data on DMX200, and there were no serious adverse events related to the drug. Whilst not achieving the primary endpoint with statistical significance, this phase 2 study in diabetic kidney disease patients has provided clinically meaningful outcomes. This is even more compelling when you consider that Unlike some other investigational drugs in development, patients in this trial received a stable dose of standard of care prior to and throughout the study, that is angiotensin receptor blockade. As a result, the reduction in albuminuria seen in the trial attributed to DMX-200 is in addition to any reduction in albuminuria already achieved with irbesartan and the SGLT2 inhibitors. Lastly, the results of this phase 2 study demonstrate that DMX-200 is a solid candidate for treating patients with diabetic kidney disease, with a good combination of a strong clinical safety record and a demonstrated proteinuric lowering capability in patients with high levels of albuminuria. The results suggest a significant clinical benefit, which could lead to a meaningful increase in the lifespan of the kidney. My assessment of these data put DMX-200 in a great position in the global development efforts for new treatments of kidney disease. This is tremendous news for those patients diagnosed with either diabetic kidney disease or FSGS, their families and their physicians. I'll now hand back to Dr. Webster.
Thank you, Professors Peckham and Roger. Clearly, this is very pleasing news for our company. DMX-200 has a long and well-known safety profile, and it is gratifying to see that these efficacy signals in all our kidney studies to date and which support the ongoing development of DMX-200 in kidney disease. Traditionally, the clinical studies were long and expensive, with endpoints being time to end-stage renal failure. In other words, how long it takes for the kidneys to fail. When the kidneys fail, it means they stopped working well enough for the patient to survive without dialysis or a kidney transplant. As you can imagine, this could be several years. With the barrier to new product development lowered, many global companies are now actively seeking kidney assets for their portfolio. I found it quite confronting to learn that 40% of people with diabetes have kidney disease, and many may not know it yet. With the incidence of diabetes growing so rapidly, so too will the incidence of kidney disease, of diabetes, sorry. This is a rapidly growing market with few treatment options at this time. With US script data indicating over 4 million scripts per year for a diabetic kidney disease treatment that retails for $590 per script, and over half of these anticipated to need further albuminuria lowering treatment such as DMX-200, it suggests an addressable market of over $1.5 billion in a market with very few treatment options. To be clear, a phase 3 clinical study in diabetic kidney disease is just too big for Dimerix to contemplate undertaking, as it will be significantly larger than the FSGS pivotal study that is currently being prepared for. As I mentioned earlier, there is significant interest amongst the global players who are actively seeking kidney disease assets, and we continue to engage with those potential partners. However, transactions in the pharmaceutical field do not happen overnight, and both diabetic kidney disease and FSGS remain high unmet needs with patients desperately seeking new treatments. The collective data in kidney disease strongly supports our plan to move DMX-200 into a phase 3 clinical study in FSGS in the first half of 2021, as well as map out the remaining diabetic kidney disease development pathway in parallel to partnering discussions. The collective phase 2 data across all three studies completed to date is invaluable in assisting the design and execution of our single phase 3 registration study in FSGS and further increases our confidence that DMX-200 will prove a valuable therapeutic option to patients suffering kidney disease and who have currently no approved or effective medication. As Professor Packer mentioned, additional analysis of both the FSGS and the diabetic kidney disease data is underway by our medical advisory board and study investigators. Any further meaningful data identified will be reported as appropriate. In the meantime, patients from the 2017 Phase 2A study, the recent FSGS Phase 2A study, and the diabetic kidney disease Phase 2 study continue on treatment with DMX-200 through the TGA's Special Access Scheme following respective study completion. This has been a transformative year for Dimerix, and I know some of you have been long-term supporters of the company. I thank all of our shareholders for your patience and your support. Dimerix has evolved significantly over the past couple of years and now has multiple assets in commercially attractive and growing markets that all have a high unmet need with little or no current marketed competition and with a potential fast pathway to market. I believe that makes Dimerix a very compelling proposition moving forward. I take the opportunity to personally thank the patients and their families who inspire us, our investigators, partners and collaborators who facilitate us. Finally, I'd like to recognise the efforts of the very small and very dedicated Dimerics team who have been working extremely hard throughout the global pandemic to deliver on promise on not one, but two phase two clinical studies in renal, as well as the ARDS opportunity in patients with COVID-19 and the earlier stage opportunity, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. I am proud of the progress we continue to make and confident together we can achieve all we set out to do. Thank you again for joining us on this call. Operator, I am now happy to take any questions.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Dennis Hume from Taylor Collison. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my question. Firstly, can you just help us understand a little better why you've measured albuminuria in this study versus proteinuria in the FSGS study? And can you give us some guidance as to how albuminuria levels translate to proteinuria? You know, is albumin roughly, 50%, 80%, 90% of the protein in the urine? Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis. I understand it's a historical question that you're actually asking, but I am going to pass this one to Professor Packham.
Yes, the answer to the second part of your question is albumin is the most common type of protein in the blood. It makes up normally about 2/3 of the total protein. The reason for using albuminuria in diabetes is traditional. The pathway in diabetic nephropathy is from microalbuminuria to macroalbuminuria to worsening renal function with increasing levels of protein or albumin in the urine. And in the comparison between trials, we always look at albumin for diabetic trials. For other trials, the FSGS trials, the data has been collected with protein. But the answer to your question is roughly 2/3 of the urine protein is albumin.
Great. Thank you for that. And also, probably again another one for the clinicians, can you help us understand the clinical relevance of these two thresholds, the 30 milligrams per millimolar or the 57 milligrams per millimolar? You know, at what point would you start treating patients? What's the relevance clinically of these two thresholds?
Professor Packham, would you like to take that question first?
So you would treat at both levels because you would always treat macroalbuminuria in a type 2 diabetic. Not to do so would be negligent. And these patients are treated with gold standard treatment with irbesartan. Now, if they continue to have macroalbuminuria, your question really is, which patients do you need to treat? In the first study we did, the patients had very high levels of albumin in the urine, and we showed a 36% reduction DMX-200. In this study, we lowered the inclusion criteria right down to 30, to the level that you consider patients to have macroalbuminuria, and we didn't see an overall therapeutic benefit. But when we've raised the level to a clinically recognized threshold, and it's 500 because that's the American value that people like, and that translates to 57 in our value, then we did see this significant effect of an 18% reduction overall. So what this is telling us from this second study in patients with albuminuria is that we should target patients above 57. Not above 30, but above 57, because we've seen at 57 a benefit of 18%, and when it's 210 as the mean starting, we've seen a benefit of 36%. And when you're talking about albuminuria, and I'd like Simon just to comment on this as well, people talk about threshold levels. So if you take a threshold level of 25, if you have a level, if you achieve 24, that doesn't mean it's not worth having. It's just where people happen to have set it. Proteinuria levels are a continuum in terms of what they indicate in terms of prognosis, and a continuum in terms of the benefit if you can actually reduce it. Simon, do you want to add to that at what level you would treat?
Yeah, I think that's important. It's very much an arbitrary line in the sand where normal albumin creatinine ratios for men and women are slightly different at 2.5 and 3.5. And then you have progressive increasing amounts of albumin appearing in the urine as disease progresses. But really, in clinical practice, we would be treating microalbuminuria in diabetics with ACE inhibitors, one of the blood pressure tablets, ARBs, or the SGLT2 inhibitors. And with the DMX-200, this will be another drug that could be thrown into the armamentarium to try and reduce the albumin loss in the urine and hopefully preserve kidney function.
Thank you. So can I just clarify, do you classify microalbuminuria as below the 30 milligrams per millimolar and macro is above that level? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so normal albuminuria is up to 3.5. Between 3.5 and 30 is microalbuminuria, and above 30 is macroalbuminuria.
And Dennis, just to add to that as well, the threshold is that's commonly used to differentiate high and low patients in many clinical trials is the 30 or the 57.
Okay, thank you. And also, you mentioned the SGLT inhibitors. Can you put if we focus on the above 57 group, where you saw that 18% reduction in albuminuria, can you put that in context compared to what's been seen with the SGLT2 inhibitors and, you know, particularly which patient groups they were tested in, what thresholds for albuminuria were used in those trials? Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. I'll start answering that question and then I will pass it over to Professor Packham or Professor Roger to step in. Essentially, the use of SGLT2 inhibitors has shown a placebo-controlled reduction in ACR of approximately 30 to 40%. Based on the proposed mechanisms of action for both SGLT2 inhibitors and DMX-200, there's no fundamental reason that DMX-200 would not add additional benefit to those patients already receiving standard of care with an ARB and an SGLT2. And we'll be able to confirm this with the planned analysis of patients on SGLT2 inhibitors in this study, which will be reported in due course. David, I'll hand over to you.
I prefer Simon to answer it because he was an investigator on the Creedon study, which was one of the key studies around the SGLT inhibitors. So I'm going to pass that to you, Simon.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what the criteria were for entry levels of albumin creatinine ratios for them. But each of these effects seem to be additive. So in the Creedence trial, where they used the SGLT2 inhibitor, canfluofloxacin, they all had to be on an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. So then they're getting a benefit on top of that. So it would be interesting in our cohort to compare the impact of DMX-200 on those not receiving an SGLT2 inhibitor versus those who did, to see what the additive effect of the Dimerix compound is.
And that's exactly what we'll report in the next few weeks.
Right. And my final question is for Nina. What do you see as the likely next steps in the development of DMX-200 in diabetic kidney disease?
Yeah, so we've developed a clinical development plan for the use of DMX-200 in a range of kidney diseases, including diabetic kidney disease. And this plan will be revised by our medical advisory board pending full review of the flood of data we have from the recent FSGS and diabetic kidney disease studies. And we'll be discussing that with the global regulators when appropriate.
Okay, thank you. That's all from me.
Thanks, Dennis.
Your next question comes from Simon Fleming from Simon Fleming Medical. Please go ahead.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, David. Hello, Simon. Just the equivalent of your graph on page 12 of your slide, I'd like to see the graphs of the overall results because that's a secondary analysis you're presenting there, and I just would be anxious to see what happened to the group who didn't improve. I don't suppose their albuminuria went up, did it?
No. So when you're looking at this, Simon, remember that this is individual patients, okay? So it's a waterfall plot. of all the patients. And if you look at the area around the curve on this side, you will actually appreciate the fact that there's a substantially sort of greater effect in this cohort. If we plotted the whole thing together, the area under the curves would be similar because there was no statistically significant difference between the two.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Luig Tidord, private investor. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I find this very interesting that you observe a 14% reduction, 12% reduction in the placebo group.
Absolutely.
So my question is, like, obviously there's a legacy effect. It would happen only in the patients that had DMX 200 first and the placebo second, compared to the one that had the placebo first and DMX 200 second. So did you look at the difference between these two groups? What did you find?
That is an excellent question, and I'm going to hand that one to Professor Packham.
That's a fantastic question, and that's what we want to know. Because as anybody with a medical background on this call will know, if you have the diabetic nephropathy is not a disease that relapses and remits. It's a chronic process that gets worse over time. So the fact that you see a reduction in patients on placebo is wholly unexpected, and there has to be an explanation for it. Now, it has been seen in other trials, but those trials weren't necessarily conducted with the same rigor as we've conducted this trial. In this trial, patients had a run-in period of stable, specified maximum dose of irbesartan for 3 months, a minimum of 3 months before they were screened. So there would be no noise. There would be established baseline treatment is there. We actually also specified that if patients were on an SGLT inhibitor, they had to be on it for 3 months before they went in. Now, despite that, we see a 12% change when patients are on placebo, and the point is exactly taken. A legacy effect is where the intervention, the drug, actually changes the clinical course of the disease so that when you withdraw the drug, benefit continues and accrues. So in this situation, because we've used a randomized crossover design, we're in a unique position compared to a standard trial, which is compared placebo with active drug, in that, as you've said, patients who received the DMX-200 in the first group can be followed for more than 3 months after they stop it. So we will be able to pick a legacy effect. And that could be part of the explanation as to why the placebo fell. Now, if that is the case, yes, it's made it sort of difficult on day one in terms of the fact that the reduction in albuminuria in placebo is 12% and 14% on treatment. But for the patient, that is absolutely huge if there's a legacy effect.
And just to add to that, the whether there is a legacy effect and or a concomitant medication effect, that is exactly what we're exploring as part of the additional analysis.
Thank you. Is there any timeline for the release of this additional analysis?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Apologies. Yeah, I was asking if there's a timeline for the release of the additional analysis.
The medical advisory board needs to go through the deeper dive of the data. That will be in approximately 2 to 3 weeks' time. Needless to say, there's a huge amount of data for them to go through. So once they have completed their analysis, we'll be in a position to report further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your next question comes from James Matthews, private investor. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning to everyone. Thank you so much for the presentation so far. I'd like to direct perhaps to Dr. Webster. It's regarding, it's a little bit off topic in terms of the REMAP cap update. Is that possible to give one at this moment? And what I'm particularly interested in is the protocol in quotes, paperwork has been completed, and are patients currently receiving DMX-200 or not? Thank you.
No problem. Thank you, James. As an update on the DMX200 in acute respiratory distress syndrome associated with COVID-19, we were awarded the $1 million from the Australian Government through the MRFF Fund towards our inclusion in that study, and for which we're very pleased with. It also supports the scientific rationale for that. We continue to work with the REMAP-CAP team projects and regulatory teams, and the International Site Steering Committee has approved the renin-angiotensin domain, including DMX200. We acknowledge that the new renin-angiotensin system domain protocol for that study, which includes DMX200, is not yet available on their website, and we will update the market as soon as we can in this regard. In parallel, our drug compound DMX200 has been prepared at our study site and at our FDA-approved global contract manufacturer, and we have engaged with the regulatory authorities accordingly. Historically, pandemics have lasted approximately 12 to 36 months, and we are unfortunately seeing some of those resurgences in the current pandemic right now. I myself am in Melbourne. Whilst COVID-19 is likely to be around for a while yet, if DMX200 does show some benefits in ARDS associated with COVID-19, it may also show benefit in ARDS associated with other infections too, such as pneumonia and influenza, and thus this provides an opportunity that could extend well beyond the impact of COVID-19. Further, the data that we have announced today, in parallel with the prior data in the renal studies, all support the mechanism of action for DMX200 in the ARDS program as well.
Thank you. And the other question I had was regarding the FSGS data. Would there be a further release of more detailed data in an approximate timeline of a few weeks? Is that correct?
There will be an update of the FSGS data in the near future, absolutely. As soon as the Medical Advisory Board has had a sufficient time to analyse the data, there was a lot of it, and that will then proceed to the announcement.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you for your information. Thank you.
Thanks, James.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Rachel Levin, private investor. Please go ahead.
I was just curious, for the FSGS trial that you have planned, what you guys are planning to do now with this new information in terms of the threshold of proteinuria and what the timeline currently is for that trial?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. Our goals are to move the development project through the clinical trials and over time to develop a portfolio with multiple products in various stages of development and leading to partnerships and licensing deals with ultimately commercial success. These data fully support our program for DMX200 and further inform us on the design of those future studies. So as such, yes, we continue to undertake planning for our proposed phase 3 pivotal program in FSGS, the rare kidney disorder, in parallel to analysis of the diabetic kidney disease data at this time.
And will the threshold for the proteinuria be, you know, maybe altered, or will you still be going for a larger patient population by keeping it less stringent as you did in the DKD trial?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. Essentially, a lot depends on what the deeper analysis is over the next few weeks. That's going to provide us with a lot of additional information. I think FSGS, though, just to put into perspective, generally have a much higher proteinuria starting level, and I'll ask David to comment on that.
Okay.
Yes, so the two, to be honest, are not comparable. I know you would like to, but you can't really translate from the albumin urea. They're totally different diseases. So when they designed the FSGS, I'm not part of the planning of that study, but, you know, realistically, it would need to be certainly more than 1 gram per 24 hours. You know, I mean, basically, you want to do your studies in patients who are going to have benefit from it. So to go for lower levels in FSGS would not be advisable. And what's good about the analysis that we presented today on the diabetics is we've established a level at which we believe patients will show benefit, and it's substantially lower than the previous study.
And just to further to add to that, thank you, David. Just a reminder that David spoke to earlier, the average baseline albuminuria in the FSGS study was 340 milligrams per millimolar, or 3,005 milligrams per gram. In contrast to that, this study had a much, much lower 111 milligrams per millimolar entry or average proteinuria at the start of the study.
Okay, thank you. And my last question is, will there be any sub-analysis or other forms of analysis on the FSGS2A trial released to us, or is the data we've received all we will be receiving?
No, there will be more data coming when the Medical Advisory Board has concluded their evaluation.
Yes, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Mark Parkjax from BioShares. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi, Nina. This is a question maybe for David. Just on that slide on slide 12, just looking at the reduction there, is with the in the chart, it's compared to placebo. The data that you've got there, is that just the overall? Is it the 64% reduction and 56% reduction?
So these are individual plots, okay, for individual patients. So if the patients are above the line, that indicates that they did better to that extent when they were taking placebo. If they're below the line, it means they did better when they were taking DMX-200. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Because if I'm looking at 25% reduction there, that's you've only got about 9 patients out of 25 or 26, which is about 34% reduction. But that's so the 56% reduction. That's from baseline, is it?
Correct.
50, yeah, okay.
No, that is placebo-adjusted there, Mark, if you have a look at the chart itself. That is placebo-adjusted. So there are 64% below the line, 56 below the 25% line.
Right, okay. All right, and just with respect to the sort of the patient population that have more than the 57 microgram per micromole. Is that sort of representative of patients in this study in terms of how many patients you'd expect to have that level of ACR?
So the level isn't fixed. As the disease progresses, the level goes up. So patients, if they get worse and progress, have more albumin in their urine. So almost all of them at some time in their disease progression will have an albumin level above these thresholds.
Right.
And what this tells you, Mark, what this tells you is those that had the lower level around the 30 milligrams per millimolar didn't respond particularly well and potentially didn't have a big inflammatory response in the kidney. Those who are generally sicker and have more of an inflammatory response with a higher proteinuria is where DMX-200 works. And that very much fits with the mechanism of action of DMX-200, where it actually works in that inflammatory pathway.
Yeah. And if I Mark, just to add to what Nina said, also please bear in mind this is on top of best therapy. So they've already shown the fall on the ARB. So this is in addition.
And so would that be what about 30-40% of patients that you're treating with diabetic kidney disease that would be over that 57 milligram per?
Depending on when you're actually starting treatment, it would be the majority of them.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I will now hand back to Dr. Webster for closing remarks.
Thank you once again for joining us on this call. With multiple assets in the development and with the statistically and clinically significant phase 2 top-line data in diabetic kidney disease patients reported today, as well as the positive data in our 2020 phase 2A study in FSGS, the prior positive data in our 2018 phase 2 clinical study in diabetic kidney disease patients, and the special access scheme uptake, we believe Dimerix is a very compelling proposition with additional assets also in the pipeline. That concludes today's call, and I wish you all a good day. Thank you.